George is a landscape architect. He's going to talk about landscape planning. And he is licensed, I believe, both in the U.S. and in Canada. So, George.
Thank you very much. And first, let me thank ASA for the opportunity to make this presentation to you today. I'm going to correct the introduction a bit because I'm a municipal planner. I'm not a landscape architect. But I did have the honor in 2013 to be made an honorary member of the Ontario Association of Landscape Architects, kind of a recognition of the fact that as a planner, I have to work with scientists, engineers, landscape architects, a whole variety of people, and including community groups, municipalities within which I work. What I'd like to do today is to develop for you a set of creation care principles that I hope that you will find useful as you go forward and leave this conference and carry on with your own endeavors. And I want to say at the outset that this is not a statement about our creeds. I'm a member of the Presbyterian Church of Canada, member of ASA. I agree with the creedal statements that our institutions stand by. This is a discussion of how I believe in the landscapes in which I live, okay? And it's based on 50 years of work experience in a variety of different tasks, environmental and land use tasks. And it also relies on my reading of scripture, philosophy, and a lot of wisdom I've gained from mentors, people I've worked with, clients I've worked with. And I'm also a trained spiritual director, and as a separate matter. What I'm going to do is focus on three major projects that I've had the pleasure and opportunity to work on. The first one is the preparation of the environmental analysis the Niagara Escarpment Commission used to prepare the Niagara Escarpment Plan for the Niagara Escarpment in the province of Ontario. The Niagara Escarpment is a limestone rock outcrop with associated geomorphology, and it extends all the way from the Niagara River, just downstream of Niagara Falls, to Tobermory, Ontario, over 400 kilometers, okay? And it covers a variety of different landscape forms, a variety of natural environments, runs through eight regions and counties, and a host of municipalities. And my task there was to help redraft the plan after it was initially drafted in the early 70s and was found to be wanting by the public. So we had to redraft it in 1979 and prepared for 3.5 years of hearings before an administrative tribunal. My task was to prepare the environmental analysis that the commission used, and what I'm going to do is describe that to you. In 1987, I left the commission and began working with Anishinaabe-Yaski Nation, which is essentially Treaty 9 and Treaty 5 communities in the James Bay, Hudson Bay watershed of Ontario. And that's roughly over 30% of the province of Ontario, the northern portion. And it includes 44 remote communities, mostly remote. And what I'd like to do is describe some of the work that I did with those communities, in those communities. And I would work with hunters and trappers and traditional harvesters and their families and their band councils on a variety of different tasks. But specifically, the review of the Ministry of Natural Resources Class Environmental Assessment, which dealt with forestry within that portion of the boreal forest, which overlapped their traditional lands. And the last thing I'd like to do is describe the work that I did with, volunteer work I did with researchers from the Canadian Public Health Association, updating the ecological determinants of public health, a document which they prepared in the early 90s to make it more current. This, if you like, is a figure that I prepared for my witness statement that I used in front of the administrative tribunals that reviewed the work of the Niagara Escarpment Commission in the course of its approval. which took place in 1985. And you can see right here the structure of the basic plan itself. The Niagara Escarpment and lands in its vicinity, the purpose is to preserve the natural environment, but you can array the lands in a continuum between disturbed and natural. And what we did was we established three basic designations to apply to those lands and identified criteria for different landscapes that would fit into those designations. And the designations are arrayed across that spectrum in a fashion which preserves the natural environment while allowing for compatible development elsewhere. And the three designations are rural areas, protection areas, and the most important, natural area. And within those designations, we also set out what people can do with their land, and more importantly, how many lots they can get and sever. That's the basic structure of the plan in a nutshell, in a figure. And it was represented in part one of the escarpment plan. Part three was the park system, which you see on the bottom. You have intensive recreation areas, natural environment parks, nature reserve parks. So that's the public component of public lands within the escarpment planning area. The three basic designations cover about 30% of the landscape each. The remaining 10% are occupied by urban areas, minor urban centers, pits and quarries. So that's the first basic framework that I want to use as a reference point. The second is, this is a statement of principles that I developed for my evidence at the Environmental Assessment Board hearing that dealt with the Ministry of Natural Resources Timber Management Class Environmental Assessment. And remember that I'm representing some of the 44 Aboriginal communities within Anishinaabe Yaski Nation that are within the area of the undertaking, within the area of the boreal forest that's covered by this. And I presented this evidence in 1993, and the 6 years prior to that, I had the opportunity of meeting with a lot of traditional harvesters, band councils, and their families in the reserves, spent time living there and in various communities, working on a variety of different tasks. And these were the basic principles that I thought were essential to adequately address Aboriginal concerns in Crown land decision-making in the province of Ontario. And if you look through those, you know, you think that they're very simple and straightforward, and I'm sure that if you read them and think of them yourself, you'll say, these are things I would naturally assume would be taken into account in a government program. Not so in the province of Ontario. The first draft of the class environmental assessment was released in 1987. Two references, incidental references. Between 87 and 93, when I presented this evidence, there were some additional changes, but in my opinion, they were not sufficient. So this was my evidence that I prepared for the hearing, and together with a number of different harvesters, we were arrayed in a panel in Sioux Lookout to present it. Prior to that, though, the Ministry of Natural Resources realized that they needed to deal with these issues, and so they met with my client and the Ontario Forest Industries Association, and we agreed to a procedure whereby we would create a settlement agreement which would incorporate these principles as tools with which to revise the plan to accommodate these sorts of issues, these sorts of concerns, very legitimate concerns. And I'm happy to say that that did happen, and in 1993, when I made this presentation before the panel, I was able also to endorse the settlement agreement, which was agreed to by the province, the industry, and Anishinaabe Yaski Nation to incorporate revisions to that document. But this is a document that I helped produce with the Canadian Public Health Authority Association scientists. And it was an awe-inspiring effort for me because I'm not a PhD, I'm not a researcher in the normal sense of the word, not a scientist in the normal sense of the word. I'm a land use planner, but public health officials within the province of Ontario like to work with planners because we deal with a lot of the same sorts of issues. And so I was a representative of the Canadian Institute of Planners in this panel of experts coming up with a document to update the ecological determinants of public health. What I felt was really important was to have something that dealt with a kind of a transition of difficulties, if you like. And I was inspired very much by Nassim Nicholas Taleb's book, which I forget for the moment. It'll come back to me having a senior's moment. But he was a financial analyst and a hedge fund operator. And he had a lot of experience where the market fails. And what he did was he kind of put forward a scheme where you deal with, when you deal with business as usual, you're really coming from a very fragile setting that he felt you had to avoid and you had to move beyond. Risk management, you have to be more robust. But where he really got into his development of his model was things like the tech boom that failed the early 2000 and the housing boom 2008. How do you gain from disorder? Okay, how do you gain from disorder? So I put this idea, this concept of this table to my colleagues, public health researchers, and we asked, and between the bunch of us, we kind of filled in the blanks using sources that we had worked with ourselves individually, and to come out and kind of flesh this out to kind of deal with the kind of complexity with which public health researchers are dealing with things like climate change, the boundary transgressions that are taking place, natural heritage, natural boundaries that we're moving beyond, and how do you incorporate that concern back into public health practices. And so that's the basics of how this works. So you have from business as usual, vulnerable, lack of resilience, risk management, resilience as capacity to bounce back, transition, resilience as capacity to bounce forward into new ways of thinking and doing. Now I want to put a proposition to you. I want you to do a bit of work too. And I'm going to suggest to you that in some of the sessions that we've been attending and listening to, the movement between narrative two and narrative three represents movement across a planetary boundary, i.e. climate change. We're moving beyond that. Now just think of your own professions, your own practices, and just begin to think of an example of what that constitutes in terms of the life that you leave when you leave this conference. I've thought about that. And I think the example I want to draw comes from my volunteer work with Clean Air Hamilton. The city of Hamilton in the province of Ontario has a very complicated airshed, partly because it's an industrial city, steel manufacturing. The Niagara Escarpment runs through it, and the Lake Ontario is beside it, it bounds it. And that creates a very complicated kind of turbulent airshed that tends to hold pollutants. Clean Air Hamilton was established in 1997, more or less to try to deal with that kind of complexity and begin to think about it. And because bad air quality results in poor health outcomes, deaths, hospitalizations, and we've quantified that and we know what it is. Benzoapyrene is a particular concern because you can see that the objective for compliance purposes is virtually nil. And it's associated with cancer, quite simply. If you look at the three monitors, three of them are industrial and one is the downtown. Between the downtown and the industrial monitors are residential subdivisions. So folk living in Hamilton are exposed to benzoapyrene, which is a definite health risk, and is well above the standard. And part of the effort that we have done we as volunteers in Clean Air Hamilton is to put together this monitoring data so that council can know it and the province can know it and hopefully people can deal with it. But the problem is that you really have a situation where the normal ways of dealing with it, land use compatibility, that is putting sensitive uses at a distance from emission sources, doesn't really work. And likewise, the regulatory system that is the province applies doesn't really work too, because, you know, for example, every time you go outside and have a barbecue, benzoapyrene is a product of incomplete combustion. So yes, we have steel mills, but we all barbecue hamburgers every now and again too. That's my example of the third category that I've described to you. Here are the creation care principles I want to leave you with. Humility is required. Absolutely. We've got to be a lot more humble than we are right now. Both humanity and landscapes have covenant responsibilities to God. If we live righteously, landscapes remain in proper relationship with God. Culture and nature are indivisible. And frankly, I think we need to discard both those terms and stop using them entirely. We're all ecological. Landscapes are representative of the world and vice versa. However, the sum of the parts, the sum of the landscapes, is greater than the world. Christ holds everything together. Now, I want to put a proposition to you. I've listened to the sessions here, and I participated in Friday's session that Lowell and John led. And I want to say to you that if Christ is in everything, then to the extent that we have transgressed planetary boundaries, we have assaulted Christ. I want you to think about that one. All humanity is created in the image of God. When I worked in Aboriginal communities, notwithstanding the residential school heritage that we have in Canada, which is deplorable, the 60s scoop, which young children were taken from families and resettled in settler communities, I met a lot of people who were Christians, and I worked with Christians, and I worshiped in their churches, even though they were, when they worshiped, they were worshiping in Ojibwe. I didn't understand anything. God works in communities whether we're there or not, and we need to be much more humble when we think of our faith and thinking about how we reach out to others. We rely on landscape boundaries to evaluate change. Our warming climate destabilizes these boundaries. If I had to do the escarpment plan again, I wouldn't do it the way I did it before, because I'd pay much more attention to flooding, erosion, the movement of species up and down the full length of the escarpment, and that requires a completely different approach. Landscape understanding is incomplete. Our senses never really fully comprehend what we observe. And mutual giving is required to reestablish stable markers and boundaries. Thank you. Oh dear, I've gone the wrong way.
Okay. I'm sorry, but I can't see the units on the y-axis. Nanograms per cubic meter?
Yeah, I think that's it, yeah.
Thank you.
So that data, was that the initiative of the community in Hamilton, or was this government organized?
No, it wasn't government organized. It was Clean Air Hamilton was set up it was a realization amongst government officials that they couldn't manage the air quality within the city of Hamilton to the normal regulatory procedures. And there was an understanding that if that airshed was going to be properly managed for the community's benefit, it had to be done by federal provincial, municipal officials, industry, and community groups. And the university and community college were also quite involved too. So it was a kind of a collaborative effort. And it was set up in a way that interested people could come and become involved. And you know, over that 20-year period, I've been involved with it for about 20 years, there were substantive things that we did, one of which was to put together a different monitoring system, because the province, one provincial administration, wanted to withdraw funding, and so it meant finding a different way to make sure that an adequate monitoring system was in place to keep monitoring. So as everybody kind of working together, and it was more opportunistic. More recently, there's the initiative has moved to electrification of the steel industry, which will have a substantial benefit. Same statement would be made in Canada too. So our cultures aren't that different, and the companies there are overlap internationally, so there's not that much difference. I think Clean Air Hamilton won a United Nations Environment Program Award as an example for how communities should manage their environments. That was an award that was given in roughly 2000 when it started. And I think it's a compelling task, because a lot of humility is required, and one has to work with people you don't agree with. Listen to them. You don't have to agree, but you work until you find something that's workable, and then the parties that can work on that task move away from the table and they do the necessary decision making that has to be done to implement it. I think that's the kind of model that Clean Air Hamilton follows. There's not too many examples of it in Ontario, so that in that respect it's fairly unique, but that's how it's done. Within the Aboriginal communities, from the early 90s, the model there was quite simply the appropriate ministers at both the provincial and the federal level retained a negotiator who was a very skilled lawyer from Osgoode Hall, a professor of law, and he acted as a mediator with the power to sanction people by reporting back to the ministers at the federal and provincial level if bad conduct was undertaken. And that kind of thing brings a bit of honesty into the process. You have to be straight up and deal with things properly and in the manner that the previous speakers spoke of with licensing. So I think that was a kind of an example, but they're few and far between, because sometimes government officials like to have the world unto their own, and it's hard to make things work in that kind of a setting, and you have to be flexible. That's why I say humility is a prerequisite. Hope that answers your question.
Are you at liberty to comment what happened to Industry 3 the last 5 years of monitoring?
What happens is something we don't see, because the ministry is of the environment is does things, the enforcement arm is something that they have to deal with, and they have to report to their own superiors and the legal profession about how they should proceed. They do exercise quite a bit of influence on the industries that are acting out of place, because they can track down, that diagram is a summary on a yearly basis. They're getting monitoring data on a fairly much more regular basis. So they can track down who the culprits are and send out their inspectors to sort out matters as best they can. But those legal processes are legal processes, they take time. But their ministry people can be pretty, the environmental law is a bit more strict in some respects than it is in the States. The Crown can be much more, how should I say, emphatic about how to do things.
I'm just curious as to why the benzoate pyrene levels jumped up the last 5 years while everyone else either went down the levels off.
Yeah, we need another year of data monitoring, I think, to look into what the wildfire effects in Western Canada were. I think it we know that, and from other monitoring in the Greater Toronto area, that the wildfires when they took place last year, and yeah, that really just everything spiked.
I don't know what that is. I just read it on Wikipedia. It's a compound to be found in coal tar, tobacco smoke, and many foods, and especially grilled meats. It binds with DNA to eventually cause cancer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So don't grill your meat.
Or be efficient, do it over a smokestack.
I think that just illustrates that some of these, when we move over a planetary boundary, some of the questions that we have to deal with are just interlinked with a whole array of things, and it really requires a special kind of, it's not a simple or a risk analysis approach.
Any questions? I was interested in your, maybe the next slide, your principles, most of which are kind of obvious. I guess what strikes me is these are nice idealistic principles. But reality, and I mean even your graph previously kind of talks about going from one thing to another thing in a somewhat linear fashion, but at least in the U.S., things can go forwards and things can sometimes go backwards. What do you think about that, and how do you deal with that?
Well, things do go back and forth in Canada, too, so you're not that different. I think principles are principles that you hold and work with as best you can under any circumstance that you find yourself. And they become the kind of core beliefs that we try to operate. Sometimes you can do something, sometimes you can't. You do what you can do and wait to the moment when you can do the other things that you can't at that moment.